Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this New Books Network podcast. My name is Catriona Gold, and today I'm excited to be speaking with Peggy O'Donnell Heffington about her new book, Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother. This book was released with Seal Press just a couple of months ago in April 2023, and as soon as I heard about it, I knew I had to read it. The book is a really fascinating and wide-ranging history of American women's reproductive choices. Well, that's one way to put it anyway, with a primary focus on women who do not have children. Its author, Dr. Peggy O'Donnell Heffington, is an historian who teaches at the University of Chicago. Among other places, she's been published in Jezebel, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and more recently, Time Magazine, the New York Times, and Washington Post. So you can find her writing in lots of places. If you enjoy this interview, check out those recent articles, and of course, pick up the book. That's enough from me for now. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Peggy.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here. So I'd like to start with asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself. So both, you know, your academic trajectory, maybe your personal connection to the topic, and also how you came to write the book. Why did you feel this book was needed, or, you know, what were you hoping to intervene in?
Sure. Thank you. So I am, as you said, I'm a instructional professor at the University of Chicago, where I teach a lot of our research and writing methods courses for history majors. So I talk a lot about methods and about writing. It's something that I'm really passionate about. It's what got me into history in the first place. But backing up a little bit, I did my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, on a topic that has absolutely nothing to do with the history of American motherhood or non-motherhood. I was trained as a European historian. I came to graduate school interested in Holocaust history, and then expanded out from there into the history of human rights. I ended up writing a dissertation on a global history of mass grave exhumations. So basically scientists going in after an act of atrocity and exhuming the grave, which again has nothing to do with this book at hand. I ended up believing very deeply, and I still do, that is a very important topic, but it was not the right topic for me to be writing. By the time I got to the end of my dissertation, I felt like I had really covered that topic and that it wasn't where I wanted to continue my work. At the same time, I left Berkeley right after graduating, and I moved to the Hudson Valley in New York to take a postdoc teaching in the history department at West Point at the United States Military Academy, which was it was a fascinating experience in a lot of ways, going from Berkeley to a military academy. One of the things that really struck me was that all of my peers, many of whom were U.S. Army officers, they were there with their families, a lot of them were my age, a lot of them had similar degrees, and all of the women had multiple children. And I had come from Berkeley, where, you know, people really didn't have children, people, my peers. And so that got me thinking about the conditions and the conditions under which people have children, people don't have children, and the history of those reproductive outcomes. So that was really what got me going on this book. I think also, you know, as in terms of personal connection, I am someone who does not have children, and I have never felt like I fit neatly into, you know, either like the infertility camp or the sort of joyfully not having children camp. For me, it's always been a more complicated thing, and I suspected that I wasn't alone in that in the present, and that it was a more complicated story in the past as well. So that also got me interested in sort of looking at the history of not having children in all of its complexity.
Right. Okay. And I think that leads us on really well into my second question, which is a definitional one. I mean, you've just hinted at this, but you called the book Without Children. So it's not explicitly about childless women or child-free women, but women without children. So could you take us through the different implications of these various terms, some of which are quite polarized, or, you know, alienating, I think, for some people, as you get at here. Tell us why you settled on this title. I mean, were there others you considered?
Sure. It's a great question. I think when you talk to a lot of people today who don't have children, the preferred term is child-free, which tends to capture this idea of choice, of agency, of opting for that kind of life. Even in some ways, a positive reframing of that kind of life. It's a reclaiming of a way of being that was denigrated for decades, for centuries, and so there's sort of a, it is the preferred term for a lot of people today. However, I didn't use that term for two reasons. One, because I'm a historian, and that term emerged in the 1970s, and so to use it before that, to apply it to people for whom that terminology wasn't available, seemed anachronistic, confusing. Much more importantly, though, is that ambiguity that I was gesturing towards in my last answer, that a lot of the history that I'm telling doesn't necessarily fit into a framework of agency, of choice, of, you know, freely opting in to a life without children. And to use that term, I think, elided a lot of that complexity. Like, would someone who experienced infertility want to label themselves child-free? Would someone who felt like they couldn't afford to have children or felt like their choices were constrained in various other ways, did child-free really fit? And because the book is really trying to capture that full complexity of all the different kinds of ways people end up not having children, I felt like child-free really didn't fit. Childless, I mean, there's a reason child-free exists. It has a negative connotation. It seems to imply a lack. So that didn't really seem particularly appropriate as well. So I fell back on something that I often tell my students in writing, which is to describe people in factual terms rather than using labels. So I tried very hard throughout the book to explain or to describe people as they lived: a woman without children, a woman who experienced infertility, a woman who wasn't a mother, a woman who chose not to have children. So in some ways, the title was a placeholder for a term that I didn't have, and then it became the term that I preferred in putting together the book.
Right. I mean, you do talk about this in the book in a bit more detail as well. So if readers are interested in kind of following up in that discussion around the terminology, obviously they should get the book. I think it's a really interesting question in it, and it was thought-provoking for me, your discussion of this question of terminology. Okay, well, let's get to the heart of the matter then. We're here to talk about your book today, and I think it's important that we give our listeners a sort of overview, in brief, of what the book actually discusses, right? Let's get in there a bit more deeply. So could you tell us a bit about the reasons you discuss as to why women don't have children? And of course, a lot of those may not be a question of choice, as you've said. What reasons do you focus on? And how do they connect with other questions of social justice?
So I did the thing you're probably not supposed to do as a historian, which is I started with the present and then went backwards. But when surveys today ask women why they're not having children, their answers are fairly consistent. They say things like, I don't have the social support that would be necessary to have children. I can't afford it. My job or professional ambitions sort of prevent it. I'm worried about the environment, the future of the environment. I'm experiencing infertility, or there are just other things I want to do with my life. The fun thing about being a historian is often you look to the past and you realize that, you know, there are people there too. They have all of the same motivations and reasons that we do. And so I found that these primary reasons women give today for not having children are anything but new. In fact, they all have longer histories. And so that's how I ended up framing the book, was with these five reasons. Lacking social support, professional ambitions, or the economics of survival, fear about the environment, infertility, and simply wanting other things out of life than parenting, and so each of the chapters 2 through 5 of the book take one of those reasons as its starting point, and then tells the history of you know, women not having children for those reasons. And as you pointed out, the only one that is really truly about choice, about sort of freely choosing from a variety of options, is the final chapter where I do talk about the child-free movement and people choosing lives without children. The other four are much more ambiguous. So for example, in chapter 2, I talk about the lack of community support, which I think can be captured in discussions about, you know, how expensive daycare is in the United States today and how that is a limiting factor on families. If you look back in history, demographers have looked at birth records and church records from French colonial Canada, and they've been able to show that the further a woman moved from her own mother, from her family of origin, from her community that could have provided support, the fewer children she was likely to have. So this mechanism of community support, it's a factor today, but it is also a factor that has a really long history. And so then the book moves through each of these reasons. In chapter 3, I talk about the ways in which career ambitions, professional ambitions, and the economic realities of people's homes have for a very long time limited their ability to have children. In the 19th century in the United States, you see women very clearly having to make the decision between continuing their job as a teacher or having children, because there were laws against women, having children and continuing in various professions. For many women, they chose to quit their job and have children, but that wasn't true for everyone. So there is the ways in which professional ambitions weigh on reproductive decisions as well. We can talk more later in the interview about the ways in which environmental anxiety or environmental concerns have shaped reproductive decisions in the past. And then I also address infertility, which, I mean, talk about not fitting into the framework of choice. These are generally people who would have had children had they been able to. And so there's of course a long history of the ways in which infertility shapes people's families and lives. So the book moves through these reasons, and each one starts with the present and moves backwards, showing that there's a long history.
That's great. Yeah. So as you say, a lot of these reasons that you discuss, they're not new, although of course they are changing over time. And women without children aren't a new phenomenon. I mean, in your first chapter, you spend a lot of time discussing the ways that women have tried to avoid or terminate pregnancies in the past, for example. I think that's really helpful. I think that's something that we forget. And I think there's an interesting tension here as well. So this is a half-formed thought, but something you do in the book is you avoid either sort of lamenting the fact that, oh, you know, women aren't having children now, but because they should be, but these things are preventing them from doing it. You're critical of the naturalization of like having children as the thing to do. And you do present that there's always been women who haven't done it. Because I find that, you know, a lot of the ostensibly progressive conversations around the reasons why women don't or can't have children, ones which call for greater social support, welfare provision, that kind of thing, they still often sort of naturalize the condition of motherhood and present having children as the thing that women should be doing. And I think your book opens up a space for being critical both of all these factors which are preventing women from making actually a genuine choice to have or not have children without reifying motherhood in that way. So if that made sense, I appreciate the way you did that.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. The first chapter was not one that I intended to write. It wasn't in the original book proposal. So the first chapter, as you mentioned, is a history of not having children. And I go way back. I go to, you know, ancient Rome and ancient Greece and gynecological treatises that record ways, you know, very ingenious ways that people attempted to avoid pregnancy or end pregnancies. And like I said, that wasn't one that I thought I needed to write, but I found myself having the same conversation over and over again with people who I think would identify as very progressive, would identify as feminists, would identify as people in defense of reproductive rights, who would say, you know, how could you write a history, a long history of not being a mother? Because wasn't the birth control pill invented in the 1950s? You know, Roe v. Wade, 1972. And that there was this sort of baked in assumption that it was modern technology and maybe modern feminist thought that created the ability of women to opt out of having children. And I realized I needed to establish that actually we can see this going way back, that women are making really conscious efforts to limit their fertility, to limit the number of children that they're going to have, to opt out entirely from motherhood. And so that you know, that this is not a new phenomenon in a really sort of fundamental way. It surprised me that I needed to establish that, because I think, as you point out, even on the political left, even among, you know, in feminist circles, there's this sort of assumption that opting out of having kids is a new phenomenon, which it really isn't.
Yeah, it's interesting that presentism, especially given that we do still have people alive today who've had abortions before abortion was legal, right? Before there was access to abortion. And of course, people are going to continue to have or try to have abortions, even now as abortion rights are being sort of rolled back. So I think it's a very timely contribution.
The book was in the final stages of writing when the Dobbs decision came out in the United States, overturning Roe v. Wade and allowing states to dramatically curtail the right to abortion to make it illegal effectively. And I do think that there's a lot of, well, that same assumption that I mentioned earlier from you know, progressives, from feminists, that not having children is this new phenomenon, I think comes into play in the assumptions about what's going to happen, which is that, you know, now all of our agency has been taken away. There's going to be forced pregnancies, forced births. And of course, in some cases, this is dramatically limiting women's options. However, nothing in the historical record suggests that abortion being illegal makes people stop trying to limit the number of births that they have. When Roe v. Wade became the law of the land in 1972, births did not drop in the United States. So that suggests that, you know, there weren't a whole large number of women who, prior to it being legal, would have aborted pregnancies who then were able to afterwards. What did drop was deaths of pregnant women by sepsis, which dropped 90%, which suggested that women were willing to take very, you know, very real risks to limit births. So yeah, I mean, I think understanding that this is not a modern phenomenon, that people have long been trying to limit births, helps us understand this new reproductive rights landscape that we're dealing with in the United States as well.
That's great. I'm really glad you elaborated on that. I think it's a really important contribution the book makes. I wanted to change tack a little bit to talk about another important contribution I thought the book made. It was that you tackled a really difficult topic in chapter 4, so Because of the Planet. And I thought your discussion here of the environmental questions around having children was really compelling. It's a very thorny topic for some very good reasons, which you do get into. You discuss the ways that population concerns were implicated in eugenics, sexist, racist, classist policies and programs, and how some of these distasteful strands of so-called environmental thinking are still alive today. So this still matters, these ugly histories. But at the same time, you also want to ask readers to genuinely think critically about our responsibility to the planet and to the beings already on it. So not in a dogmatic way, but you are posing those questions in a way that you don't often see, because I find that these conversations do tend to get short-circuited in a lot of spaces. Talking about the environment and the child question together, because of these very difficult histories, it's a hard conversation to have. But I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about how you see or how the people you wrote about saw the intersection between reproductive choices and environmentalism. Give our listeners a sense of the environmental rationales, historical and contemporary, for not having children, because this is a reason that women have given for not having children. So it does matter.
Yeah, absolutely. This chapter, it felt really, really important to include in the book. A recent survey of young people globally, people under 25 globally, found that 6 in 10 said that they were concerned about having children because of climate change, which is like, this is a really dramatic statistic. And yet, it's not a conversation that, for a whole variety of reasons, is taken particularly seriously. In the United States, across the political spectrum, I think that this tends to be dismissed. I'm thinking about New York State Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went on Instagram Live several years ago and just commented that young people today are thinking about whether it's ethical to have children because of climate change. And she gets pilloried on conservative media. Fox News called her, said she was advocating for civilizational suicide. But even on the political left, I don't think it's taken particularly seriously. And yet, for many young people, this is a really live, thorny, ethical problem that they're living. One of the things I wanted to do with the chapter was to show that once again, this is not a new phenomenon, that people have been thinking about the ways in which the environment and their reproductive decisions will intersect for a very, very long time. And in the chapter, I trace sort of two distinct intellectual lineages. One is the idea of your child causing harm to the environment. And I think today we could think of that as expressed in people who talk about the carbon footprint of babies, that having a baby is the most carbon intensive thing you can do. It's far worse than flying on an airplane or eating meat or whatever. And the other one is people thinking about the harm that the environment will have on your child. And so I trace these two lineages. The former is the one that gets really, really complicated historically. That one, I trace it back to Thomas Malthus. His essay on the principle of population in 1798 makes the argument, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar, that human population will increase until it hits some sort of unsustainable level where there aren't resources to support it, and then something terrible will happen to knock the population back down, like famine, war over resources, disease. Malthus is not an unproblematic figure. He is mostly writing with concern about how many children poor people are having. He also is concerned about Britain not having a revolution like France just did. So he wants to keep like the elites in power by making sure we tamp down population of poor people. And his ideas were later used to justify racist and colonialist population control programs. Everything from eugenicist movements in the United States that tried to, limit urban poor populations to, on a global scale, for example, Lyndon Johnson's administration in 1965 refuses to send food aid to India unless India institutes population control programs, which results in a massive sterilization campaign. So these have sort of, it makes sense to me that people have backed away from that sort of thinking. The other intellectual lineage I trace in the book is, I think, much harder to dismiss, and it is more in line with what I hear from young people today, which is that, you know, I'm not so much concerned about the harm my child will do to the environment. I am concerned about my child's experience of an environment that has already been harmed. And this, I mean, of course, this has a history. Anthropologists have shown that primates limit their fertility in times of environmental distress. It's completely logical that a parent-to-be would be concerned about whether the environment they live in could support another life. So that's where I think the real heart of environmental concerns about reproduction is coming from today. And I think you can take that all the way back to you know, sort of fundamental instinctual things, but also in times of famine, in times of environmental distress around the world and throughout history, you can see people limit their reproduction. In part, starving bodies are less fertile, but I also think that we can't, we have to assume that people are making decisions about limiting their reproduction.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Right. I think it's a really interesting conversation, and obviously one we need to have very carefully. As you say, there are these two questions that women might think about, or any potential parent might think about. Of course, it is both, how will my having children affect the environment, and how will life be for any children I bring into the world given human environmental devastation? I definitely recommend this chapter to any reader interested in those questions, because it's quite hard to find a discussion that doesn't, okay, maybe it's not that hard, maybe I haven't looked hard enough, but I find that the tendency is for people to position, because obviously there are these horrible, awful histories of state-controlled reproduction, any question of thinking about the environment in relation to having children gets thrown out altogether. And I find that frustrating, given, as you say, that this is a very real concern for a lot of young and indeed not so young people who still might be thinking about having children or not. So to me, there's a third question, which is that as life becomes more difficult as a result of climate change and a bunch of other factors. I mean, quality of life in the UK, where I live, has certainly been plummeting in recent years. I think just about everyone, but maybe Steven Pinker, would agree that we're not doing well. We're not getting better over time at the moment. I think these environmental questions really sharpen this other aspect of why people may choose or not choose to have children, which is caring for humans and other beings already in the world, and how having children, making that choice, might or might not impact one's ability to do that. And I think that segues well into the other question I wanted to ask, which was about Ella Baker, who's one of the figures of several inspiring and really interesting figures you discuss in the book, and the sort of more expansive ideas of mothering and care that her story helps you shed light on. So maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, Ella Baker was one of my favorite historical figures that I encountered in the book. So of course, Ella Baker was a prominent figure in the American Civil Rights Movement. She was active in the NAACP. She, you know, traveled across the South in the 1940s when it was incredibly dangerous to do that, recruiting members of the NAACP, talking in church basements to people and sort of advocate, you know, trying to mobilize Black Americans in the South to advocate for civil rights. She was later the national director of the NAACP, and she was also not a mother. And these two things are not obviously connected, but in her, they really deeply were connected. She was quite clear that not having children of her own allowed her time, space, love, care, energy that she could then expend on advocating for the future of her community rather than sort of ensuring the future of her immediate offspring. This came from this understanding of the expansive ways that one could care for their community came from her upbringing, which was she grew up in rural North Carolina in a town that she described as family socialism. Basically, she described it as families really helping each other. Her family was relatively well off, and she talks about, you know, sharing her family's farm equipment, sharing her family's vegetable garden, that she would take care of the kids down the street whose mother had passed away. And in fact, as an adult, she ends up serving as a mother figure to her niece, who ends up moving to New York City to live with Ella Baker and her husband. Ella Baker is 42 when she gets the call, "Can you take your 7-year-old niece?" And in her recollection, she doesn't even blink. She's like, "Of course, that is what is needed of me." And so I think in the figure of Ella Baker, you can see a really radical expansion of what the word mother might mean, what it might mean to care for a community. She's thinking everything from providing, you know, real material care to the children, the biological children of other people, to caring for your neighbors down the street, to advocating for the future of Black Americans. For her, those are all linked acts of care. And like I said, she was aware that she would not have been able to do any of those kinds of care for her community had she had, you know, 4 children of her own that required her love and energy and attention. So for me, encountering Ella Baker and understanding the ways in which her social justice work and civil rights work and her non-motherhood were profoundly linked helped me think more broadly about what motherhood could mean. And conversely, it helped me understand how narrow our conception of what a mother is or what it is to mother has become over the last, you know, century and a half.
Yeah, the way you discuss this, it's clear that choosing is not always the right frame, but not being a mother can be just as much an act of care as being a mother. And I think the women you choose to illustrate that are really compelling. And I think, and I didn't know about most of them. So I wonder if you could do a little run through of the impressive and diverse set of historical figures you talk about in this book who did not have children, and tell us a bit more about the range of movements or causes or organizations that they were part of.
Yeah. One of the really wonderfully fun parts about writing this book is that women without children are not some sort of coherent niche group within society. In the period that I'm talking about in this book, say the last 200 years of American history, women without children comprise something between 1 in 5 and 1 in 3 American women. So this cuts across race, it cuts across class, it cuts across religion, profession, interest group. So it's just talking about a really, really broad range of human experience and lives. And so that made the research really fascinating, because I'm talking about everyone from an 11th century nun named Christina, who, you know, goes through all of these trials to avoid marriage, to lesbian separatist groups in the American 1970s who are, you know, setting up communities that are only made out of women, to Helen Gurley Brown, who was the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan magazine from the 1960s to the 1990s, who had a very sort of like a corporate girl boss reason for not having kids, which was, you know, if you want to be professional like a man, you got to act like a man. And kids will prevent you from doing that. To people like Ella Baker and Carrie Steele Logan, who founded the first orphanage for Black children in the American South after the Civil War, as a way of caring for her community. To Simone de Beauvoir, sort of leaders of their field. So it was just a really, really broad expanse of human experience. And it was something that shouldn't have surprised me. But the way I had initially conceived of the book was, rather than framing it around reasons why people didn't have kids, I had it framed around groups of women without children. So I had, you know, nuns, and I had a chapter on, you know, like leaders of their industries. And I quickly came to realize that that was unworkable because separating women without children into five buckets just was completely inadequate to capture the full range of lives and interests and experiences that they had. So yeah, in the book you will meet a whole range of women's experiences.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of range, you mentioned earlier the 1970s emergence of the term child-free. And though that's not the main focus of your book, for reasons you've already discussed, I'm guessing our listeners might have expected us to talk a little more about that. So let's hop over briefly to that other end of the spectrum and talk about a group you discuss in your final chapter, the National Organization for Non-Parents, or NON, who I actually hadn't heard of before reading this book. So it was sort of a joy and also a little cringy to discover them, as they're the group that maybe have the most in common with the types of child-free people love to hate today. Fairly or unfairly, maybe sometimes fairly, as you get into. But I would love if you could talk a little bit about NON and some of their more dramatic stunts, I suppose. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So the National Organization for Non-Parents, or NON for short, was founded in the early 1970s by a woman named Ellen Peck. In 1972, Peck published a book that was very briefly a national bestseller called The Baby Trap. The Baby Trap, the title sort of gives you a sense of the vibe. The Baby Trap is one part a critique of pronatalism, the idea that the state or society is sort of expecting, incentivizing, or even forcing people to have children. So it's one part a critique of pronatalism, and it's one part a celebration of a life without children. Peck is a really interesting figure. By all accounts, she was very beautiful. She was very glamorous. She was very, very wealthy. She and her husband owned three houses, including one on a private island in the Caribbean. They traveled. They ate fabulous food. They had this fantastic life. And in The Baby Trap and in a lot of her advocacy, Peck frames these as the effects and benefits of a child-free life, not really allowing that those might be the effects and benefits of just being really rich. But for her, she was countering the expectation that women should become mothers by showing all of the benefits that she understood to come from not being mothers. This didn't win her a lot of fans. In defenders of the traditional family, conservatives, like you were saying, it confirms every bad stereotype they have ever encountered of people without kids, that they're selfish, they wildly spend money, they're hedonists, whatever. But on it also didn't win Peck many friends among feminists. The women's movement at that point was much more focused on improving the conditions under which women became mothers and mothered than it was on validating not having children as a lifestyle choice. And as one prominent feminist writer put it, Peck basically saw motherhood as something that you only did if you were too dumb to avoid it. And so this sort of created a lot of tension between her and more mainstream factions of the feminist movement. However, for a lot of people who did not have children, the existence of Non was transformative. I found one quote from a woman who was in her 60s when she joined Non, and she said that joining Non, finding this organization, allowed her and her husband to go from being a childless couple, which they had been for decades, and turn them into a child-free family, which is not just semantics. I mean, that's a real like transformative experience. It expands the definition of a family. It makes a claim that a couple without children could be a viable family unit. And so the Non disbanded in the early 1980s. It was the Reagan era, sort of a tough time to be expanding the definition of what family means. But I do think the legacy of Non lives on in a lot of ways. Peck and the organization popularized the term child-free, and also there remain offshoots of this group. There are child-free cruises now and sort of social organizations that are modeled on Non for people without children. But as you said, there's also a cringy part of this that if you look at Non's membership roles, they tended to be heterosexual, white, urban, wealthy. They were not thinking in really radical ways about how to restructure society. They were just trying to say, you know, people without children can also be respectable middle-class families. So there's a real, there's sort of a, I guess, a complicated legacy that the organization has left us with. But in terms of pushing the conversation forward, introducing new language, starting to recognize not having kids as a valid lifestyle choice, I think we're seeing a lot of the effects of that play out today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously a really important group. And I mean, shout out to them for holding their Non-Parents Day ceremony in 1974. I loved the discussion of that. It features Isaac Asimov placing laurel wreaths on the heads of a young man and woman, crowning them Non-Parents of the Year, among other things. I was like, I was not expecting that detail.
And they had for the first Non-Parents Day in 1974, they had this ceremony, like you were saying, in Central Park. And they also had spandex clad dancers doing a non-fertility dance, which, I mean, just completely bizarre. But the funny thing is, so Non designated August 1st as Non-Parents Day, and they do all of these spandex-clad stunts and re-crowning Non-Parents of the Year. If on Instagram, August 1st is an Instagram holiday of Non-Parents Day, and I think a lot of the young people posting about that probably don't know the connection to the non-fertility ritual that happened in 1974 in Central Park. But the core idea of, you know, we have a day that celebrates mothers, we have a day that celebrates fathers, and here is a day that celebrates people without children, that has remained a really powerful concept.
Right, yeah. And if anything, I mean, we maybe should be looking to bring back the spandex and the non-fertility. I mean, yeah, maybe someone's already doing that, but I'm for it. Okay, so as we sort of move towards the end of the interview, it would be really great to hear you talk about any women you would have liked to include, because it's not like there's any shortage of inspiring women in history without children. So are there any women you particularly would have liked to add that you weren't able to?
One of the pieces of the book that got left on the cutting room floor, I had probably, I mean, I'm sure it was overkill, probably a 5,000-word section on Rachel Carson, who was sort of a pioneer of the American environmentalist movement. She's the author of Silent Spring, which shed a light on the harms of DDT and ultimately resulted in it getting banned. She is mentioned in the book very briefly now in, I think, one paragraph. But Rachel Carson did not have children. And much was made of this in the public around her. There was just a lot of like journalists being like, this is so confusing. This woman seems to care about the future of the environment, but she has no children who will live in it in the future. So why would she care? And even within the US government, there's a lot of confusion about this. Like, you know, this woman without children is concerned about the environment after she's gone. She must be a communist. But which I found like very funny and very revealing, that because it suggests how deeply ingrained the idea is that the only way we could possibly care about the future is if our own DNA is going to continue living in it, which is a very strange and limiting concept of how we can care about other human beings. One of the reasons I cut Carson was because her non-motherhood was very important to people around her. It did not seem particularly important to her. In fact, she ends up adopting a nephew and serving in all material and emotional ways as the mother to a very young child until her death. So I found her to be a sort of more complicated person to include in the book. And she belongs in a different book, which is about stigma or the ways in which society interprets women without children rather than how they live their own lives. Because I think at least her final years, she lived them very much as a mother. So she was someone who largely got, cut from the book because I felt like I was imposing an identity onto her that wasn't one that she necessarily would have identified with. In more fun, I tried very hard to figure out how Julia Child could fit into the book, and I ended up not including her. But I think that there is a very fun piece to be written about Julia Child. There's some evidence that that she was unable to have children, and that was a source of great pain for her earlier in her life, and that later on, you know, she ends up living life to the fullest and sort of capitalizing on the opportunities that not having children could allow. I'd love to write that piece, but I couldn't fit her into the book.
Right. I'm sure there are plenty more, but that's absolutely fascinating about Carson. And I hope that other piece that's about stigma, I hope that gets written at some point by you and we get to read it in some venue.
I'm going to make a note of that right now.
Yeah. So obviously you're working on that right now. But other than that, what else? What I'd like to close with is just to ask you what else you're working on at the moment.
So, aside from the Julia Child piece and the stigma piece, that first chapter that I talked about conscious efforts to limit fertility got me interested in the history of women's healers and midwives and sort of folk knowledge and the ways in which women's reproductive lives was very much the domain of women until the middle of the 19th century when sort of medicine becomes a professionalized and therefore increasingly male-dominated thing. So I'm sort of formulating a book about the history of midwifery, which feels quite connected to what is happening in the United States today, where reproductive rights are under threat, and also maternal outcomes are not good, and there's sort of increasing efforts on the part of women across the political spectrum to reclaim birth and reproductive rights or reproductive life as a woman-centered practice. I think there's all kinds of interesting historical parallels there. So that's something that I'm thinking through. It's half-baked would be an overstatement at this point, but that's where my thinking is going.
Right, great. Well, I look forward to reading about that too. It's super interesting stuff and clearly connects well with this book too. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today, and obviously it's been a pleasure to read this book. I had actually read the book before I even asked you to talk about it. I was so excited to see it, and it did not disappoint. So highly recommended.
Gosh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peggy, for coming on the show, and thank you to everyone else for tuning in today. Once again, my name is Catriona Gold, and I've been speaking with Dr. Peggy O'Donnell Heffington about her new book, Without Children, The Long History of Not Being a Mother, published by Seal Press in April 2023. I highly recommend picking up a copy from your local bookstore, direct from the publisher, or from any ethical retailer. Thanks all for listening, and thanks again, Peggy, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.